This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Did you enjoy your statehood holiday weekend? Well, it's throwback time. You may have caught snippets of music from the Woodstock Festival over the weekend as we also marked the 50th anniversary of the Hippie Culture Concert in upstate New York. We decided to ease into our manic Monday start of the week by stretching out the weekend vibe. We begin with conversations around memories of Woodstock from Hawaii residents who were there in 1969. Some Kauai residents of Taylor Camp, the hippie camp, recall the time. Andy Parks was in the Taylor Camp band, who had connections with the band The Rascals. Remember them? Parks was 17 years old and recalled the wild and crazy event where the music and the drugs flowed freely.
When I was walking, my girlfriend had gone and talked to other people, came back and handed me a pill and said, "Oh, it's acid. Take some." And I said, "All right, sure." And I took it, and as soon as I ate it, she said, "Oh, well, that's," he said it was four-way. I'm not sure what that means. So I kind of started off with that. And all weekend, people were just giving me acid, and I said, "Sure." Actually, you know, they had years ago in the movie, they had a guy making announcements, "Oh, you know, don't take the brown acid," or whatever it was. And I knew that what happened was this: at one point, Wavy Gravy got up there and said, "If you took the green acid, go directly to the medical tent." And somebody had just given me some green acid, and I ran over there to the medical tent, and I was totally freaked out. And I went, "I took the green acid. What am I going to do? What should I do?" And he went, "Well, do you feel okay?" And I went, "Yeah, I feel great." "But you said, come over here." He said, "Well, if you feel okay, never mind." I was so high on Saturday night when The Who was playing, I could hear them, but I could not get up. I was lying there in the mud, and I kind of became the part of the earth and kind of hovered above everything. That was my one memory of being there but not being there.
Another Kauai resident, Charles Ressler, recalled Woodstock as a watershed event for the country.
I was there for, you know, the main part. I was there for the beginning. I was there when it rained like hell, you know, and I was there and, you know, listened to the great music, you know, all weekend. You know, the media coverage that we've had this past week is, I knew it was going to come up because 50 years is always 50 years, but you know, it was a really dividing line in the culture of America. Now, obviously, I don't speak for, you know, all segments, you know, the South, the Midwest, et cetera. But for a lot of us in the East, in the West Coast, the East Coast, and even the Midwest, it was a transition from, you know, the old culture of Ozzie and Harriet to a new, more wide open, expansive culture filled with more possibilities. And I think Woodstock was that dividing line. Because you have to remember, after that, they had the Altamont Festival, and which was a disaster. Someone was killed, actually. And that was, oh, it's the end of the Aquarian Age. Well, yes and no. It was a short Aquarian Age. You know, that Woodstock was really a countercultural event, an anti-war event, a drug use event. And it changed the culture in that way, you know, when you think about it.
And so as you thought about your memories this weekend, I guess, what are you left with?
I have mixed feelings. You know, on a personal level, being there wasn't this ecstatic experience all the time that you even saw in the movie itself. You know, it was dirty and we didn't have enough food. The toilets were disgusting, of course. But the music was great, and that's why we were there. And to see the gathering of groups like this, that's the first time that this has happened. And we all knew it. That's why we bought the tickets. That's why, you know, the gates were overrun. There had never been a collection of groups, probably in history, of any form of music like this, and for over such a time period. I don't recall any festivals up until that point being over a day. And the ability for people to accommodate and get along. We saw no violence. There were all kinds of people there. People helped each other out. And, you know, I mean, they're bragging from the stage. We're the second largest city in the state now. And, you know, everything's great, except for the brown acid, which, of course, scared everybody. What kind is he talking about? Just the takeaway was a transition.
And do you have a favorite song from that festival?
I have a favorite performance, and that was the Santana performance. Because it was unexpected. You know, most and many of the other groups were well-known, but Bill Graham, the famous impresario from San Francisco, Haight-Ashbury District, came out with the announcement, oh, this next group, I know most of you probably haven't heard them. I don't think they had an album out by then. But they're really rocking the house in the Bay Area. You know, you got to give them a listen. And they came out and tore it up.
And Kailua resident Kevin Jordan joked he got Alexa to play Woodstock music all weekend to reminisce about an adventure he had with his little brother and their girlfriends 50 years ago. He was 19.
The music was new to me, and it was, I mean, I had heard of some of the groups before, but many of them I had not. And so I was really captivated by the music, and I was overwhelmed by the size of the crowd and the apparent harmonious of behavior of everyone. And one of the things that struck me was that the Army, U.S. Army, and it could very well have been a New York National Guard, but they were flying constantly. They were flying helicopters in, delivering water and medevacing people who, you know, had various medical problems. And I was very impressed by how the Army handled that, because it was, you know, it was not something that was planned. It was a crisis. It was the middle of August, and there was no water. And they had to basically supply water to, you know, 500,000 people over several days. It was really extraordinary. And that impressed me. And the fact that you know, there were no fights or riots or anything of that nature, it did impress me at the time. But actually, when I look back, I realize how extraordinary that was, because I don't think we would have that type of benign environment today, were 500,000 young people to get together to listen to music. I mean, it would be, you know, I just don't think it could happen again today.
Well, it was a peace culture, you know, make love, not war.
In a sense, it was. And that's why my reaction to the Army, you know, sticks with me, because I thought they did an extraordinary job. And, I had a vague inkling that, you know, things could go south in a hurry if there was no water or food. And, you know, the army guys were taking care of that.
And you ended up having a career in the military.
I did. I of course, at that time, the draft was quite very much in effect. Everybody was, you know, thinking about what they would do should the college deferments end and so on. But then I chose to serve in the Marine Corps as a commissioned officer shortly after graduation. Just before I retired from the Marine Corps, I was assigned to Pacific Command, and I was a colonel at that time. And I was in a meeting with a number of young officers, you know, majors. One of them was talking about the rock group Queen. And I said, Queen, who are they? So this Air Force major says, Colonel, how is it possible that someone in this day and age could not have heard of Queen? And I said, well, Major, I think it has something to do with the fact that you know, after I went to Woodstock and was exposed to the music there, I haven't heard anything since that was anywhere near the equal. And he says, "You went to Woodstock." And he says, "Colonel, I take back what I said. You have rock cool forever."
Rock cool forever. That's what Jordan says Woodstock was all about. It was groovy. And we end with the concert promoter's viewpoint. Leroy Jenkins is with Waikiki's production partners. He was a DJ at KPOI in 1969. He recalled his mentors, Tom Moffat and Ken Rosine, and how the spirit of Woodstock lived on in the concerts in Diamond Head Crater.
Hawaii was happening. It was definitely a place to be. I'm truly honored to actually be part of history back then in Hawaii. But Woodstock, oh my gosh, what memories they were. I mean, our first Diamond Head Crater, we started at sunrise. We had Santana play late. I think we only had like 14, 15,000 people. It went on for years, but I think it lost its luster because in the beginning it was free. I remember standing on stage and seeing people climb over the top, and they were coming through the tunnels, so it was hard to keep account. But over the years, it turned into a money event. I think, if I remember correctly, the Department of Land and Natural Resources said that's it. So it grew, and I know the size of the crowd grew. We would never get to the size of a Woodstock, but I think it probably got up to about 75 or 80,000 people before it ended.
Rock cool history from Woodstock to our own crater concerts. The first KPOI FM Sunshine Festival in Diamond Head Crater was held as a way to promote the new radio format of KPOI FM. About 10,000 people attended this free event and got to enjoy a day of music, food, arts, and crafts.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Kumu Kahua Theater. Ua Pau, It Is Finished, Over, Destroyed, is the final play in Alani Apio's Kamau Trilogy. Opens this Thursday. Tickets at kumukahua.org.
Anyone who has seen it from the air or from the ground knows it's a funny-looking thing. You know, that large white dome floating in Pearl Harbor? The golf ball, as many call it, is actually a sea-based ballistic missile radar that is capable of transoceanic travel. It's officially called SBX-1, and the military recently opened its doors to media. HPR's Ryan Finnerty was on hand for last week's tour and files this report.
If you work on the SBX-1, the daily commute requires climbing 13 stories of narrow, open-air scaffolding and catwalks. That's higher than the deck of an aircraft carrier. Let's just say, you wouldn't want to drop your keys. The sea-based X-band radar is the only ship of its kind in the world. It was built using an off-the-shelf oil rig from Norway, which was heavily modified in Brownsville, Texas by the Missile Defense Agency. My guide today is Bob Dees. He's a retired Navy officer and has been managing the SBX program for 17 years.
SBX is mobile, so as we drive around the ocean, we change what the defended area is.
The SBX is so large, it couldn't even fit through the Panama Canal. It had to be carried around the southern tip of South America on a heavy lift cargo ship. On the football field-sized main deck, the giant white bubble, called a radome, reaches 250 feet above the ocean surface. The radome looks rigid, but it's actually made from several layers of heavy-duty canvas and resin.
Two layers of Vectran for strength. They're 90 degrees from each other to help prevent any ripping. Urethane in between. And then the outer layer is a hydrophobic and anti-ultraviolet damage coating.
Like a sports stadium, the radome is held up by air pressure. A higher pressure is maintained under the dome than Earth's atmosphere. You actually have to go through an airlock to get inside.
We're in the airlock, so we let the air out. We filter air and blow it in, and we've got a vent at the top, so we're continually changing the air. And it circulated to blow around.
What's the air pressure inside?
It's equal to, at the low wind, about 2 inches of water. So very, very little. That's fractions of pounds per inch. then we get up above 11 if the winds get above 80 knots. So then your ears will really pop as we come through.
11 inches of water.
11 inches of water, which is you'll see the radome has got a lot of square inches for providing that. When we had the repair work up on top, the guys said they could feel no give to the radar. We had to head it up at the stage 3, 11 inches of pressure.
In May, the SBX returned from a deployment that lasted more than 500 days. Those repairs Bob mentioned marked the first time in the ship's 15 years of service that the radome required patching. Once inside the dome, the massive radar, weighing 4.8 million pounds, rises 8 stories above us. 45,000 individual transmitters allow the SBX to see an object the size of a baseball from over 2,500 miles away, and it can look in any direction by rotating on a 360-degree track. Says newer radars may be more powerful, but few can match the unique flexibility of the 15-year-old SBX.
The large aperture is what is really special about the radar. Largest X-band phased array radar in the world. We're actually in the Guinness Book of World Records. Most of them are a fixed sight. Those radars have a greater field of view than SBX, where we have some limitations on the amount, but we can turn. We can elevate up to 90 degrees and turn back and forth in order to scan.
5 defense contractors provide the ship's 75-person crew, who do everything from navigate to cook meals. There are typically no uniformed military personnel on board. While underway, the crew live in quarters that Dees, who remember was a career Navy officer, says are more spacious than what he had while in uniform.
This is an example of the stateroom. This is a one-person stateroom, where most of the staterooms on board are two-person and bunk beds. Each of them has a TV, they all have telephones, and they've got the bunks. The two-person is a bunk bed arrangement. And then they also have the showers and heads, the toilets, connected. On the bunk, we've got an immersion suit. Immersion suit is something used in cold water areas, so if the crew had to abandon ship, they would put on an immersion suit and a life jacket before they go into water. It gives them hours of survivability instead of the hypothermia problems you get very quickly if you're just in your regular clothes.
With resupply, the SBX can remain at sea for well over a year. It typically meets a supply ship every 3 weeks to maintain stocks of fresh food. Drinking water is made using an onboard desalinator. Crew members rotate off every 2 months or so. Leaving the vessel requires riding in a large orange cone that gets suspended between the SBX and a supply ship.
We suspend this from the fast hook on the crane, and then we throw your bags inside the netting in the middle. You step on the footprints that are painted on the deck on there, and then you grab hold with your hands on the upright ropes. Each lift we can do a dozen. This is how you get on and off SBX from the offshore supply vessel. It's actually very safe because the transition time for getting onto it and then getting picked up is very short. So everybody throws their bags in, steps on, they pick up. You worry a lot about if you're in an in-between state and the vessel moves. Then you're not in charge of what's going on. As soon as they pick you up, then you're on a very stable SBX.
We can't take you inside the classified room that controls the missile tracking radar, but we are able to visit the bridge, where the ship's officers navigate and steer the giant vessel, which, remember, was designed to be an oil rig. 2 identical stations are used to control the SBX, much like the cockpit of an airplane.
This console is a duplicate of this one, so if we have a problem with one, we've got one automatically. These are common with the oil industry. It's one of the versions that they have. And it's one that we upgraded a couple of years ago from the original ones that were on board. Electronic charting and display to assist the mate on watch.
So these are the same types of controls you'd see on an oil rig?
They are. For the navigation and control, when we get on station, they'll tell the ship to stay in position. They'll give it a heading. It'll do all that automatically. the radar consoles. We've got surface search radars. We've got automatic identification systems, so each of the ships will squawk its information, so you know who's in the area, and if you need to call them on the radio, you know what the ship name is, so you can address them that way.
Could you tell us about that cameras, Bob?
We're up on the bridge, but if you look, if you're on a Navy destroyer, you'd have bridge wings that you could walk out on to see. From here, it's still a long way. You wouldn't want to be away from the bridge that long. So we got navigation cameras that we can train around and look to see visually what we might see on the radar. We've also got safety cameras that we can look at many of the positions on the ship. We've only got 10 engineers on board, so they stand all the watches around the clock. So you can, if you get an alert on a system, over here, the integrated monitoring and control system, we've got about 1,600 monitoring alarms and locations around the ship. If you get an indication, one of the ways, quicker than having someone run down it, is to bring up a camera and look and see what's going on down there. At the same time, somebody's headed in that direction to help.
Although the SBX has operated out of Pearl Harbor since it launched in 2005, Bob D. says each port visit is put out as a competitive bid. The ship has opted for other Pacific Naval shipyards in the past.
Normally, that will be a competitive contract that's put out to all the U.S. Pacific shipyards. So the same way we went to Seattle once for maintenance, next time we come into port, I can't say that it would definitely be Hawaii. But we do enjoy the hospitality of Hawaii and the base and the support we get from the Hawaii shipyards.
Senior defense officials are also studying the possibility of permanently relocating the SBX to the U.S. Atlantic coast, but a decision is still years away. So for now, the Pearl Harbor golf ball will remain a fixture of the Oahu coastline. From the flight deck of the SBX-1, I'm Ryan Finnerty for Hawaii Public Radio.
And you can find photos from the tour of the one-of-a-kind SBX radar ship at hawaiipublicradio.org. It is now time for our rail reality check with our partners at Honolulu Civil Beat. We take a closer look at a design flaw that's been in the news. Reporter Marcel Henre on the line this morning. Morning.
Aloha, Catherine. Happy Monday.
Happy Monday. And details, details, details.
Yep, devil's in the details here. So, yeah.
So explain to our listeners, this little design details cause big headaches.
Right. So what we're talking about here is the canopy arms for the stations on the future rail line. There have been issues with these arms that came up earlier this summer. About a week and a half ago, we had the opportunity to take a site tour with HART officials. And HART will, from time to time, give tours and media access to really give an idea of how the rail line is taking shape and to kind of give people a sense of what it might be like to eventually use it. But it's also an opportunity to have a look at some of these issues that come up in their board meetings that we just kind of see in PowerPoint presentations, and they're just kind of abstract. So this was a really good opportunity for myself, for other reporters. Our photographer, Corey Lum, took some great shots that looked at some of the specific things that have come up in these meetings, most notably the canopy arms. And the problem with these canopy arms is that they're cracking. They believe that they started cracking in the galvanization process during fabrication. They're not sure if it's a design flaw, if it was directly a problem with the fabricating or some measure of both. They're still trying to sort it out. But the reason why we're so concerned with these, why they're so significant, is that the canopy arms, while providing shade for passengers and the like, they're waiting up on these platforms, out in the elements, They're also designed to carry these conduit and cables that are essential to the communication system. So if the canopy arms don't work, a lot of other things don't fall into place. And they're working to fix the situation, but it does remain kind of a concern as they're trying to rush right now to make that interim opening to Aloha Stadium in 2020.
Yeah, so it's holding things up.
Yeah, it's in more ways than one, these canopy arms are. They have kind of a long history, or at least for the past several years. It wasn't just the cracking, but this goes back to millions of dollars in change orders, at least $4 million, to deal with design issues for these canopies. Back in 2016, they were revising designs because they were designed to kind of emulate, you know, the traditional Polynesian sails, kind of think Hokulea, you know, the traditional va'a and the voyaging canoes. But much like normal sails, these canopies were taking on loads and greater loads than the station was designed to basically handle with the wind and the like. Then there were constructability issues, and it wasn't quite clear what that meant. It was really good to get out on site and kind of see just how complicated of a design, just random branches kind of jutting out from the trunk of the canopy arm. And apparently that's caused a lot of headaches for the contractor, and they butted heads with the designer. So if you go to Civil Beat and you look at the story, it's kind of a good visual log. You know, the photos kind of guide along as to what the problems have been over these years.
Yeah, there's no substitute for actually seeing it. I remember being at a HART meeting where we were looking at those cracked shims, those pads. And when you can actually see it, instead of just having someone talk about it, it really does drive it home.
Right. It opens it up. So we were able to see the stations and how they're coming along, but we were also able to see, a lot of the issues that have kind of plagued construction over the last several years.
Okay. It's kind of away, oy vey.
Right.
All right. Thanks so much, Marcel.
Sure thing. Thanks, Catherine.
That was reporter Marcel Henry with today's Reality Check. To read his stories on this issue, visit civilbeat.org. You may have been lucky to have had a three-day weekend with the commemoration of Statehood Day last Friday. The actual Admissions Day event took place on August 21st. We take the time to spotlight an event that will be happening that day and this weekend. We share a couple of short readings from the Founding Documents, Founding Voices, Living History presentation. In this one, James Bright reads from a July 2nd, 1894 speech by Hawaii patriot Joseph Nawahi.
The house of the government belongs to us as the Kamehameha's built it. We have been ousted by trespassers who entered our house and who are telling us to go and live in a lay stand that they think to build and force us all into. I am telling you, my fellow citizens, we should not agree in the least.
And this is Matthew Kelty reading the words of Alexander Hamilton. In the Federalist Papers, he discusses why the Senate should be a check on the president's nominations.
To what purpose, then, require the cooperation of the Senate? I answer that the necessity of their concurrence would have a powerful, though in general a silent, operation. It would be an excellent check upon a spirit of favoritism in the president, and would tend greatly to prevent the appointment of unfit characters from state prejudice, from family connection, from personal attachment, or from a view to popularity.
Now, the dramatization was born out of a nationwide grant to examine the founding era of this country. Waianae librarian Cheryl Lynch ran with the idea, inspired by dramatizations at Iolani Palace, marking the Onipa'a commemorations called Mai Poina. Now, we sat down recently with Lynch and director Sammy Choi. The words on paper led to the creation of the 18th century Republican Constitution and Government of the United States and the 19th century Constitutional Monarchy of the Kingdom of Hawaii.
I've worked with Gilder Lehrman Institute for American History in the past on other events that they've had or promoted at public libraries. So when this initiative was presented, they contacted me because I had worked with them before and asked me if I was interested. And so I said, sure. You know, they have provided funding for some kind of program. And since it was about history and trying to promote conversation in the community, I remembered going to the My Poena things and thought something like that would be awesome, about the American history, you know, and using primary documents, because that's a big part of this. They use all primary documents and they've created these readers. Having worked with Sammy and Craig before on a number of things and knowing their expertise in Hawaiian history, I contacted them and asked them if they would help me think through this, because I thought American history is interesting, but the founding era of the Kingdom of Hawaii was basically the same time frame, and I thought comparing those two would be super interesting. So I asked Craig House and Sammy to help me think through it, and that's how we got started. And then we thought maybe some kind of a play. You know, Hamilton's really popular and they talk about that, but I didn't think that would fit the bill, so I knew Sammy would have some good ideas, having gone to My Poena.
And so, Sammy, talk about how you took this idea and ran with it.
Well, we had, as Cheryl says, we had meetings with Craig, the three of us, and we decided to commission Victoria Nalani Newbel to write a living history piece, which is similar to My Poena in that you have characters costumed as people coming from whatever time period you're choosing, and they discuss what's happening in their lives today. So with this, we have one person from the late 18th century in the United States talking about how the United States founding documents came to be, the Constitution, all the bylaws, Bill of Rights, all of that. And then we have a character from the 19th century in Hawaii talking about the different constitutions. And it's really interesting because you see the vast difference between how these documents originated. In Hawaii, it was a monarchy. So those documents did not come from the people. They were instituted by the sovereign. Whereas in the United States, we, from history classes in high school, we know where those documents came from. And they did not come from a monarch. So we have a comparison going on. And it's a really good reminder of what the two countries' ideals were at the beginning. Because we're living in the 21st century, and things are really different now.
And the first performance will actually fire off on August 21st, which is actual admissions day. So lots of threads in there about politics and, our state and on our country. Talk about that.
Well, actually, the date was just lucky because we're doing it at the high school. And when you are doing programs at the high school, everything is dictated by their class schedule. So we were very, very lucky to have the high school librarian, David Manthai, participate with the library to help bring that programming to the students, because a big part of the funding grant requires that you present this to students. They didn't say what age students, but knowing what the seniors at the high school study, democracy in action and current Hawaiian history, I thought it would be a really good marriage. And I think it's going to be really great for the students and the teachers and everybody that gets the opportunity to see it, whether at the high school or at the library.
And I love the idea of the compare and contrast.
Yes.
The two time frames. Talk about the challenges maybe, you know, when you were doing the research for this.
Well, it was tremendous challenges because I'm not a student of history, whether it's American or Hawaiian. So what I did is use the resources of the people I know, specifically Craig Howes and his relationship with Mrs. Newbel, and ask them to help with that. And the results are, I think, enlightening. And I'm very excited to see it. I've read the play many times. I've learned something every time I've read it.
And so talk about the actors, Sammy, how you were able to get this group to put this on.
Well, the two actors are an American male and a Hawaiian male, which I suppose is historically accurate since women were not all that involved in politics at the time. They are necessarily modern actors. The blessing is that they're both trained in theater. So what we've done is go through the text, which coming from 18th century United States can be pretty dense. So we know how to break it down and have it make sense. It's like breaking down Shakespeare verse. The actors have to know exactly what the speaker intends and how the speaker's feeling about what he's saying in order to communicate it to the audience. So yeah, it's this is a very wordy play. In fact, it's all words. So yeah, that's the challenge, to get to high school students who are coming to see a very wordy play right after lunch.
Okay.
But when we're talking about these pieces of dialogue from the 18th century, you look at, for instance, I want to bring this up, the Alien and Sedition Act of 1798. There, the Federalists were arguing for aliens, immigrants, to be thrown out of the country very, very easily, whereas the Democratic Republicans were arguing for, no, we want immigrants. And the resonance with what's happening today is amazing and really interesting when you look at people who call themselves Federalists today.
There's a quote by David McCullough, who is on the chair for this Revisiting the Founding Era, and he says that history is the antidote to the hubris of the present. And I thought that's so interesting because there's so much going on in the state right now, and so many of the things that we get a lot of requests for the David Malo book because they want to know what did he say when it comes to the things going on over in Mauna Kea. So I've been rereading that or looking at it for the first time. And so all the primary documents that they've issued for this play, because they're all primary documents, it's interesting to reread them and see what they actually did say.
And so when you worked with Victoria, what were her thoughts about trying to mount this production?
I think it was a challenge because we don't really have action, right? We just have two people presenting material. She also had to digest an enormous amount of source material and then condense it into what will be about a 45-minute show. So I think one of the things that struck her and has struck all of us is, as I said before, the resonance of what people say. For instance, George Washington, when he was giving his farewell address after his two terms, he says, "I have already intimated to you the danger of parties in the state." And he's talking about factionalism within the government and the danger of parties just existing for themselves, not for the good of the people, but just to elevate themselves. And I thought, I didn't know he'd said that. But man, all the way from George Washington to now, the danger of parties becoming so polarized. He was talking about that then. And so, here we are today. So I think for all of us, it's been a long time since we've had civics lessons, right? So it's been a fabulous reminder of where we come from, not just the United States, but of Hawaii as well. Hawaii now has a fairly liberal state constitution. However, it is good to be mindful of the fact that when the first people in Hawaii were trying to set up a new constitution, they were talking about making a more level ground, bringing more equality between the chiefs and the Maka'ainana. And yeah, that I found really inspiring.
Now, because this will be staged here on Oahu, I always have to wonder, You know, is there any chance that this would go to the neighbor islands?
I am looking into getting it recorded. So if nothing else, the possibility that we could send it around, and we'll see how it goes. If people are really appreciating it, like I am hoping and thinking they will, then maybe we can continue and look for funding to go to the to the neighbor islands, because Hawaii has such a unique perspective on this.
That was Waianae librarian Cheryl Lynch and Sammy Choi talking about an upcoming production entitled Founding Documents, Founding Voices. It'll be performed at Waianae High School on Wednesday. The public performance will be 2 p.m. Saturday at Waianae Library. And we now check in with astronomer Christopher Phillips and HPR's Dave Lawrence with your Monday Stargazer.
Stargazer time, our weekly look into the massive universe around our tiny planet, and also things we can try and spot in our dark skies. As usual, we're very lucky to have the expertise of astronomer Christopher Phillips at our disposal. Christopher, welcome back. What do you have in store this week?
Hey, Dave. Good to be here. So this week, stargazers look out for Jupiter and Saturn in the southern sky after sunset. The moon this week is passing through its last quarter phase, and so skies will become darker as the week draws on.
Now, you mentioned the moon, and unbelievable as it may sound, Christopher has a claim of life on the moon in his report this week. What is going on?
Indeed. There is life on the moon. Well, perhaps. The humble tardigrade, or water bear, is a microscopic eight-legged creature that lives predominantly in water here on the Earth. And they're found in all sorts of places, from tropical rainforests right the way to the Antarctic. And now they have entered the final frontier. An Israeli moon lander carrying water bears as part of a scientific experiment crash-landed on the moon, scattering these microscopic creatures all over the lunar surface. To see one of these guys, you have to look at them through a microscope.
And you're telling me somebody's got a tool that heavy and they can see them crawling around up there?
No, they were sent there as part of the payload package, so we know they're out there somewhere.
Okay. Now, I'm guessing there's no invasive species rules yet for the moon, but one never knows. What's the story on that?
You're right. Right now, there isn't. Space law, as it's currently written, would only get you into trouble if you've left something like weapons or experiments that may interfere with other scientific explorations. When it comes to biological organisms, space agencies are basically left to police themselves with little to no global oversight.
And also on the flip side, sometimes, just like with invasive species on Earth, they change what's happening, take over and stuff. Is there a chance they could have some sort of negative impact up on the moon or breed into an out-of-control species up there?
Well, the water bears themselves are incredibly resilient, but in the absence of water, they essentially enter a state of inactivity. They self-freeze dry, which enables them to survive conditions that would otherwise destroy organisms. This means they are probably happily asleep on the lunar surface and could potentially stay that way for decades.
So it sounds like a water bear colony on the moon isn't really going to happen unless they start getting some rain or something up there.
Exactly, which is a long shot.
It's Christopher Phillips and another fun report here on Stargazer. Thank you.
You are welcome, Dave.
And I'm Dave Lawrence. We'll catch you next week. And you can find Stargazer at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for Stargazer comes from Ferraro Choi, committed to environmentally sustainable architecture and interior design. FerraroChoi.com.
You know, the weather temperatures may occasionally dip down into the 30s on Mauna Kea, but this summer, the topic of TMT, the 30-meter telescope, is still a very hot one. HBR's Kuuwehi Hirishi joins us in the studio with more on that.
Yes, aloha, Catherine. Last week, we looked at sort of the emotional responses that folks have to seeing these images that are pretty much going viral on Mauna Kea, going viral on social media. So images of Kupuna getting arrested, but also just videos of protesters sort of doing their thing up there. But for Native Hawaiians, these sights and sounds can sometimes serve as reminders of past injustices and triggering what the American Psychological Association calls historical trauma or cultural trauma. Spoke to clinical psychologist here in Honolulu, Robin Miyamoto, who's an assistant professor at JABSM at the John A. Burns School of Medicine, to give us an idea or explain this idea of cultural trauma.
So similar to if we think about post-traumatic stress disorder, somebody who's been through a traumatic event, a lot of times we think about military or somebody who's been injured in a sexual assault, those traumatic events impact their ability to take care of their health in the future. And cultural trauma is the same thing. It's just that that person doesn't need to have directly experienced that trauma. It can be something that happened to their kupuna, but has resulted in a loss, whether it's a cultural loss, a loss of land, a loss of power.
That's right. So it's the first instance that folks might think of, right, back in 1966, the first instance of research into cultural or historical trauma was a study done by a Canadian psychiatrist documenting high rates of psychological distress among children of Holocaust survivors. Right. So that was sort of the first instance into this idea that historical trauma could exist. But the field as a whole is relatively new and young. And so finding ways to sort of link cultural trauma or historical trauma to different aspects of health is something that folks over at JobSum have been doing at the medical school in terms of connecting cultural trauma to higher rates of chronic diseases or to behavioral health issues. So on the other hand of that coin, it's interesting. It's sort of like anyone who's experienced or whose kupuna have sort of experienced this loss, cultural or land or self-determination in that case, will kind of get triggered by seeing these images and by experiencing what's going on the Mauna. But also on the other hand, those who are in law enforcement or in, you know, on the other side of the coin, it's not just those that are protesting that experience this.
I think on the other side of things, besides the protectors, I'm also seeing people who are being asked to be there as part of their job, and they are Hawaiian, and whether they support the telescope or not, they are having to remove people who may be their friends or their neighbors or their family members, and it's causing stress for them as well.
So some of our psychologists have been putting together listening sessions, creating safe spaces for anyone really who's feeling a lot of stress from what's going on Mauna Kea to come and have a safe space to sort of air their frustration, cry in a safe space, get angry in a safe space, and kind of let that go, which is sort of the therapeutic side of what's going on. So Kea Vikaholokula, professor and chair of Native Hawaiian Health over at the medical school, says there's an empowerment aspect to what's going on in the Mauna as well.
Things like this often are stressful and causes a lot of anxiety, a lot of oftentimes anger and frustration, because it's a social justice issue that we as Kanaka have been struggling with for a very long time in protection of our natural and cultural resources. On that hand, it's a reminder of the historical trauma. The flip side of that coin is this sense of empowerment, that it's allowing us to have a voice. It's providing us a way of venting our frustrations in a positive way that will hopefully, you know, lead to some significant advancements in our revitalization of our culture.
Fascinating.
It is, and it's interesting to see this play out, I guess, and watching folks who are engaging in kapu aloha, so this idea, this code of conduct where it's very disciplined, despite all that possible anger or hurt that one might have when they feel these triggers. When it comes to kapu aloha, when you're on that sort of battle line, they have to discipline themselves in a way that, you know, will eventually need some sort of outlet. So once so Robin Miyamoto has been working with several individuals that have been making treks up to Mauna Kea and back and working with them constantly, whether it's FaceTime while they're there or when they come off the Mauna, to have that outlet to kind of let some of that go, because it's a very disciplined sort of code of conduct while you're up there.
Right, so it's kind of compartmentalization, but it is a very emotional issue, and then trying to deal with that stress and working through that.
Right. You know, it's exactly what it is. And Kaholokula, it was interesting to hear him say, you know, the idea of having possible routes for action. So being able to go to your rally in your community, here on Oahu or on Maui versus having to go all the way up to Mauna Kea, sharing something on Facebook. These little things that make folks feel empowered by this will help serve as some sort of therapy to this entire process.
But I can see, because we're just coming off of Statehood Day, Admissions Day, and there's a lot of things wrapped up in that, you know, how do you right the wrongs?
Right.
How do you deal with the reality that we have today in dealing with the political structure and the economic structure? But it's like those wounds, you know, there's a scarring, and those wounds are tender when these incidents, when the anniversaries come up.
Exactly. Those little triggers, as these psychologists were saying, are very much there. And it's opportunities like this to let some of that go and, you know, not have to hold it in for so long. That's really helping folks process it all.
All right. Well, thanks so much, Kuvehi.
Thanks, Catherine.
We've been hearing from HPR's Kuvehi Hiraishi, unpacking the baggage around Mauna Kea and the 30-meter telescope.
Underwater explorer and photographer Jill Heinerth has dived into unmapped caves deep in the earth and beneath a giant iceberg. She's seen hidden creatures old as dinosaurs and witnessed scenes of surreal beauty. Her work is so dangerous, 100 of her friends and colleagues have died in dives. She has a new book, and we talk with her on the next Fresh Air. Join us.
This afternoon at 3, following On Point.
We do have to go, but up tomorrow, we continue to talk about the mana of the mountain. We have a call-in show, and we'd like to hear from you. Call in live or join the conversation or call our talkback line and leave your comments. Here's that number, 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Post your comments on the Facebook page at The Conversation HPR or tweet us at HI Conversation. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.